This case, as I said, is taken under advisement, and we will move on to case number 2 for this morning, United States against Mason Johnson, 13-1350. Mr. Brindley.
May it please the court. My name is Beau Brindley, and I represent the defendant appellant Mason Johnson. Mr. Johnson appeals from the district court's failure, or I guess allowance, of admission into evidence of an eyewitness's identification of the defendant's picture in a six-pack photo array. I'd like to begin with the question whether the photo array was indeed suggestive. Now,
but before you get too deeply into that, I want to know whether your argument is that it's just automatically suggestive if somebody has an array instead of sequential pictures. And if that's your position, I want to know where you find support for that.
Your Honor, it is not my position that it is de facto unduly suggestive if you have a simultaneous versus sequential array of photos. There are obviously a consideration of all the factors together. Now, this court in Ford did indicate explicitly that the use of a simultaneous array can indeed raise the likelihood of suggestivity, and I think the fact that they did that militates in favor of a finding of suggestiveness, but other factors have to be considered as they were in Ford. Judge Posner in Ford did not say that was decisive, but he did find that that
Counsel,
did indicate a degree of suggestivity.
The decision was rendered by a panel of three judges, not by a single judge. Opinions of this court speak for the court.
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize for that. He wrote the opinion.
No,
I was only referring to that.
We do not engage in ad hominem arguments.
I understand, Your Honor.
Then why were you making one?
It was not my intent. I simply referenced Judge Posner as he wrote the opinion in Ford that I have been referring to, Judge. I apologize.
But at the end of the day, if you take what the Supreme Court has said about these kinds of identifications, photo arrays, and other identification mechanisms for that matter, you need to look first and see if there's something suggestive about it. And the only way you can do that is to look at the array. And I'm sitting here looking at this array, and I'm having trouble understanding why you think it's so problematic. I mean, it looks to me like there are a variety of men in this picture. Some are darker complected, some are lighter complected, but they all are, you know, in the natural range of variation. So what's suggestive about this? I don't see number three leaping off the page at me.
The reason that it's our position that it was suggestive is because the agents that put together the array knew that the witness had described someone as being dark-skinned, black, and bald.
And three, four, and five are all, give or take, you know, dark-skinned, not much hair, and African-American.
Respectfully,
they're all African-American, it looks like.
No, they certainly are. They're certainly all African-American. That's true. I think that, and we argued in our brief, that really there's only two of them, three and four, who would qualify as being dark-skinned. The other thing that the agents knew, having seen the defendant's photo, was the facial hair that the defendant has, a goatee-style beard. And there's no one in this array that's dark-skinned with that kind of facial hair. The facial hair is all different from everybody else. There's not, that style of beard doesn't appear on anybody else who I think could be characterized as dark-skinned objectively.
But the witness was cautioned to be careful about the photograph in terms of its depiction of how dark or light or otherwise skin appears, and also cautioned that hairstyles, beards, and mustaches may be easily changed. So the witness is told the real person may not even be in this array. We don't know. It's
that,
for you to say.
That admonishment was given in the Ford case as well, Your Honor. The same admonishment, I think, exactly was given. It's read off a card, I believe, or a piece of paper they have standard.
Well, this woman signed it, according to exhibit.
Certainly. And I think that in the Ford case that argument was also made, but the court in Ford found that the fact that argument, that statement is made, does not necessarily do very much good when in fact, and that was during the portion of the argument, or the portion of the opinion, I should say, where the simultaneous array was being discussed. because a simultaneous array, according to the Ford opinion, gives rise to the person making a comparison and picking the most like person rather than explicitly looking at each picture and deciding if that's the person or not.
So even if you're right that this is suggestive, and I'm deeply dubious about that, but even if you were correct, Ms. Williams had a fair amount of time with the two people in the car, Mr. Prince and Mr. Johnson. And so I'm also having trouble thinking, even if we got to step two, why it isn't a reliable identification.
Well, when you get to the reliability inquiry, the Supreme Court's announced several factors.
Right, and I'm looking at them. She had plenty of opportunity to look at his face.
That's the one factor that I think is in the government's favor here. She had a lot of time with him.
Even stressful time. It's not like he was pointing a gun at her. For all she knew, apparently, she was just driving the two around, running a few errands.
And that's what brings us to the second factor, which is the degree of attention she would have been paying to this individual and his appearance. This individual's riding around in the back seat of the car with her. She's not believing there's anything significant about it. There's no indication she's turning around paying that much attention to him. You factor in that she's apparently smoking marijuana with him. Well, she's in his presence. They're smoking marijuana together, which...
But we have no evidence in this record about the effect of how much marijuana or about the effect of marijuana in general on somebody's ability to identify. It's certainly not the same as alcohol.
It's not the same, Judge, and it wasn't developed in the district court. As appellate counsel, I can't go back and change that. But... the fact of the matter is that was a factor that she was smoking marijuana, and I don't think there's any indication that there was any reason for her to pay particular attention. The record also doesn't indicate that she was paying particular attention to him for any reason. The other factor about how accurate the prior description was before they did the identification, I don't think helps, because she said they were looking for a very short individual, about 5'3". The defendant turns out to be approximately 5'7", I believe. And so that suggests that the prior identification wasn't that reliable. And then when you factor in the degree of certainty that she had, this was a person who did the identification and then admitted, I'm not 100% certain. So the degree of certainty is certainly not to the point where that's going to be...
Well, she doesn't swear it. I mean, the one thing, if you want to save some rebuttal time, I mean, the third point is, even if it was a mistake, and I'm doubly dubious about that, there's a lot of evidence against Mr. Johnson, and you have to deal with harmless error.
Of course, Judge, and with respect to
after you get the phone and the picture that he takes, you know, that it's the red BlackBerry Curve, that his own photograph is on it, that he's got, that there's this picture in somebody's lap with lots of money.
Yes. The issue with the phone, I'll address the phone specifically since you bring that up. The phone, that day the person using the phone was, and the evidence bore out, Mr. Prince had been on that phone using that phone. And the only way that that phone becomes a phone that the defendant had on that day is if the jury finds credible the testimony of Prince. And in fact,
and
I think...
Williams finds the phone in her car just about where Johnson was sitting.
And Prince was also sitting in the car and staying in a similar vicinity, I think, Judge.
Well, but it's a phone with Mr. Johnson's photograph on it.
It's also the phone that I believe Williams said that...
And the phone company traces the records to him.
That's true.
That's his phone.
That's true. But Williams herself, I think, admitted that Prince was using the phone that day, that she called the phone and Prince answered it. And if that's the case, then we have to rely on the testimony of Prince and finding him believable in order for that phone to become as compelling evidence as it is. And in fact, I think when you look at all of the evidence, and we went through this in the reply in some detail, all of the evidence outside of the objective corroboration from this identification requires, at least to some extent, a belief in Prince's testimony, and there was all kinds of reasons for the jury to doubt that. And so
so that's the problem.
Right, well, but the objective corroboration of the identification, it's my position,
right,
is why they didn't judge.
Okay.
Counsel, before you
yes,
sit down,
Your Honor.
I'm interested in why you did not order a transcript of the district court's explanation for her decision to permit the identification from the photo ID, but not to allow the witness to identify the defendant in court. That's a very peculiar thing, and our rules require the appellant's brief to contain the district court's explanation. I tried to search, and I found you just didn't order the transcript.
And, Your Honor, the reason for that was I was retained by the defendant very late after he had counsel. I requested an actual extension to do that, to get that transcript. The court indicated that that extension would not be allowed because I had come into the case late.
And so you just never ordered it at all?
After the government counsel indicated that they were going to order the transcript as
they
part of the
either.
Response.
It's very peculiar. We're being asked to assess the propriety of a district court decision, and neither side has supplied us with the district court's own explanation for the decision she made.
And, Your Honor, I've stated the reasoning that I have. That's the reason that I have for either way that we... This
but
was the best issue
we
had.
You don't the reason the district court did what she did. Nobody knows, or at least we don't know. Nobody's bothered to tell us. The rule is very clear.
And, Your Honor, we put into evidence what we had available to us at that time. We put that into the record with our appeal.
If for some reason you could not get the explanation by the time of your opening brief...
Yes.
You asked for the transcript and include it with the reply brief.
And it was my understanding that...
You certified compliance with Rule 32, and this brief does not comply with Rule 32.
In that respect, Judge, I apologize. It was my understanding that government counsel had ordered the transcript, and I don't know if they relied on it in their response brief or not. You might ask government counsel.
They did not, but evidently it didn't make any difference to you because you didn't go try to look for it.
No, Your Honor. You're right. Thank you.
Mr. Zuer.
May it please the Court, Paul Zuer for the United States. I'd actually like to work backwards from what the argument that Mr. Brindley just made.
Is that true? Did the U.S. Attorney's Office promise to order that transcript and then not do it?
I don't know about promising, but we did order the transcript, Your Honor, and it's cited in the brief. It's the July 3rd, 2012 transcript.
We were told that it was not in the record. No one had ordered it.
I actually have a copy of it right here, Your Honor. It was ordered, and
well,
it should be in the record.
So we can get it.
And it is cited in the brief. I will say, Your Honor, that the...
Certainly would have helped us if you'd included it as an appendix to your brief. We, you know, the rule doesn't require the appellee to include what the appellant left off. But those things that the appellant leaves off and should have included, it really helps us when the appellee does include them.
Of course, Your Honor, and I'm sorry for not including it in the appendix. I thought that transcript made its way up to this court. I'm sorry if it didn't. I know it was ordered, and I know it's cited and referenced and actually quoted in large part in the government's brief. I can say that the district court in that July 3rd hearing said...
Is this at page 11, 7312, transcript 2-3?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Defendant didn't argue about the reliability of the photo array. Okay.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. The district court essentially reiterated her position at the start of trial on July 9th, the position that she made in the hearing on July 3rd. And it is
referenced. Just to slake my curiosity, did the district judge ever explain why she did what she did, allowing the identification from the photo spread, but not an in-court identification? Because that seems absolutely backward. Under the Supreme Court's decisions, the in-court identification is supposed to be allowed unless the lineup or photo ID produces a substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification. So when a district judge bars the in-court identification, the judge must have believed that there's a substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification. There's no other reason for barring in-court ID. And if the judge believed that, I don't see how the judge could have allowed the identification from the photo spread. The judge must have explained this someplace, I hope.
She did, Your Honor, both in that July 3rd hearing and, again, at the start of trial. on July 9th, again, both of which are referenced in the government's brief. The reasoning was this, Your Honor. Her concern was that the six-pack array itself, the photo of the defendant in the six-pack array, was possibly going to alter or confirm her view of who the defendant was, or who the person sitting in the backseat of her car on January 16th, 2011 was. The government wasn't fighting that point.
Did the district judge attempt to explain how this was compatible with the Supreme Court's decisions? As I say, it seems to have those decisions on their head.
She didn't explain more, Your Honor. But I will say the government took the position and made the point to the judge that we weren't going to introduce an in-court identification anyway. So I think that's part of the reason why she didn't explain more on the record. Her view was that she didn't need to. This wasn't really a contested point. The only contested point in front of the judge at that moment was whether the prior identification, the six-pack photo array, was going to be admitted. That was the one piece that we were disputing and fighting in front of the district judge. Going to the harmless error point, Your Honors. Mr. Brimley made the point in his brief, he made it during his argument, that the evidence really just comes down to Joseph Prince. I know, Judge Wood, you mentioned during argument a moment ago that you see an abundance of additional evidence against Mr. Johnson. There was. I want to point out a few key pieces of evidence that the defendant is overlooking. One, Amanda Williams testified that Prince's friend, the person whom she saw in the back seat of the car, was pictured on the screen of the phone that she found. That's important. That's at trial transcript page 538, lines 17 to 23. The significance of that testimony is that that's independent identification testimony of the defendant. She's saying that regardless of the six-pack ID that she made, she saw the defendant's friend, the person who was sitting in the back seat, on the phone. And the government introduced those pictures at trial. So the jury got to see the person whom Ms. Williams was referring to when she said that she saw that photo on the phone. It was the defendant. Second, Ms. Williams testified that Joseph Prince sat in the front seat of the car. The phone was found in the back seat. Again, that's separating Joseph Prince. The defendant tries to argue, and the defendant tried to argue in the district court, that it might have been Joseph Prince who left the phone, that Joseph Prince was the one in possession of the phone. Well, that doesn't make any sense just in terms of spatial reference in the car. The phone was in the back seat. Joseph Prince was in the front seat. Third, Carlita O'Neill testified that the defendant told her that Prince got into it with a white girl. This is a quote from the transcript at page 581, and that they jumped out of the car and that he lost the phone in the car. Again, additional independent basis for the jury to believe that Mason Johnson was the one in possession of the phone and Mason Johnson was the one who was sitting in the back seat. Finally, regarding Prince's credibility, I think Your Honors recognize that the jury did find Joseph Prince credible, and we know that because of the fact that the jury convicted on the conspiracy count, count one in the indictment. That count was largely predicated on Joseph Prince's testimony. He's the one who explained the agreements that they were getting into, explained how they came up with the idea to rob the bank on December 20th, 2010, and then again to rob a bank on January 16th, 2011. Going now to the question about the suggestiveness of the array. Your Honor's right, looking at the array, there's nothing unduly suggestive about the array. I do want to respond to one of the defendant's arguments in the brief and touch on something that's referenced in the Ford case, a suggestion that it might be tending toward de facto or per se improper, unduly suggestive to introduce photo arrays. The psychology research that I've seen is very unsettled in this area. I can give two examples of the status of that research. One is I provided a 28J letter last night that suggests that it attaches some research from UVA from November 2013. That research suggests that, one, it's possible that there are fewer false identifications with a sequential array versus a simultaneous, but that there are fewer hits overall with a sequential. So people are making more false negatives as well. The other thing that research finds, is, and which is concerning, is that the people who make false positives in a sequential array tend to be more confident, significantly more confident in that false positive hit, meaning that you get to trial, you've got a witness going on the stand with a false positive saying, I am confident that that person is the person who committed the crime. That's concerning if we're concerned about making the distinction between simultaneous or sequential arrays, which one is better. That sheds light on the possibility that a sequential array really isn't better. The other piece of research I want to cite, too, is actually something that the defendant provided in his brief at page 20 of his appendix. He has an article in there that's actually contradicting and questioning the methodology of some of these simultaneous versus sequential array exams and tests that psychologists are running, and actually challenges one of the papers cited by the Ford opinion for the basis of saying that the sequential array is preferred. Unless your honors have any additional questions.
Counsel, this is Judge Kaney. Just to follow up very briefly on Judge Easterbrook's inquiry, I gather that this was all the idea of submitting a transcript of the concerning the judge's comments about the array were done after the briefs were filed?
No, Your Honor. The government actually took and requested a 45-day extension to file its brief. I noticed when I got the defendant's brief that he didn't reference this pretrial hearing in front of the district court judge. I got an extension and ordered the transcript at that point. Again, I believe that the transcript had made its way up to the Seventh Circuit.
That's why we don't have it.
Did you file it electronically?
Transmitted earlier.
I'm sorry? I heard two questions.
Did you submit it electronically?
I don't remember, Your Honor. And if I didn't submit it electronically, that's my fault, and I apologize for that.
But that may be part of the problem.
That might be, Your Honor. But I do know that I referenced it in the government's brief, and there's no response to it in the defendant's reply.
Well, I think the point is, I mean, there's one thing, which is the record in the district court, and by ordering the transcript, you may have completed that, but there is a second step, which is getting it from the district court up here, and I think that's where things fell apart.
That might be, Your Honor. With that, the government asks this court to affirm the judgment of the district court.
All right. Thank you. Does Mr. Brindley have any time left? No, you used your time, Mr. Brindley, so we will take the case under advisement. And we will move on to...